Now, when we invite Peter Singer to Naples, it's with the understanding that this brilliant director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence is the very person that can educate our graying heads to the mystifying world of cyber. And he believes that it is incumbent upon all of us to become aware of the invisible threats of the cyber world. This is not a learning curve that's confined to the next generation or to the techie crowd, but to us. And again, to make this easier for all of us, Peter's book, Cyber Warfare and Cybersecurity, will be your primer, and it will be available after the lecture at the book table in the back of the room. It's filled with tons of delicious, digestible bites. That's B-Y-T-E-S. Dr. Singer reminds us that President Obama was elected with huge help from the internet and all the social media outlets that are free to us in this country. But he also needs to secure the future of the internet and preserve its free market value and openness against the many governments who attempt to regulate it and control its use. Dr. Singer's research focuses on three core issues: current U.S. defense needs and future priorities, the future of war, and the future of the United States defense system. He lectures frequently to U.S. military audiences, which he will be doing immediately tomorrow up in North Carolina, and is a prolific author of books, well, we know that, and articles relating to those issues. He's a graduate of Princeton University and received his Ph.D. in government from Harvard University. As the father of two little boys, I would feel certain that their bedtime stories are certainly in the cloud. Welcome, Peter Singer.
So thank you for the incredibly kind introduction, and to all of you for coming out, in particular to Mimi and Judith and the rest of the council for the hospitality that has been shown to me down here. So I'm old enough to remember the very first computer that I ever saw. My father took me to a science center in North Carolina where I got to learn how to program this incredible machine to design a smiley face out of the letter M printed out on one of those old spool printers. Remember the perforated paper you'd tear off the side of it? Now, since then, the centrality of computers to my life, all our lives, it's almost impossible to fathom. The very first website was created in 1991. We now live in a world where there's more than 30 trillion websites out there. Today, for example, we live in a world where there's over 40 trillion emails sent every year. Moreover, the internet's, it's not just about putting information online or sharing it. Through the emerging Internet of Things, and what this is where Cisco, for example, estimates that over the next 5 years, we'll see more than 40 billion internet-enabled devices. So everything from your smartphones, but also to things like smart cars, smart thermostats. Google just spent $2 billion for a thermostat company. It's not about the thermostat. It's about how it links into a smart power grid. But what we're saying here is when you have 40 billion devices linked up, that's way more than the people behind the devices. And so the Internet of Things is about the devices carrying on conversations without us, making decisions without us. But what I'm getting at here is that as you see all of this coming together, domains that range from communication to commerce, to critical infrastructure, to even conflict. 98% of all U.S. military communications go over the civilian-owned and operated internet. All of these spaces are dependent on the internet, and we're truly entering what the chairman of Google called a new digital age. But this incredibly important, but very short, when you pull back and think about it, history is reaching what I would argue is a defining point. Just as the upside of the cyber world has rippled out there with all sorts of unexpected consequences, so too has the risk side of it. There's a lot of different ways you can drive home cyber risks. One would be by the numbers. For example, every single second, 9 new pieces of malware, software designed to cause computer harm, every single second, 9 new pieces of malware are discovered. Or if you want to think about the targets, 97% of all Fortune 500 companies, including Target, have openly admitted that they've been hacked. The other 3% of the Fortune 500 have been hacked too, they just haven't admitted it. If we want to focus on war, more than 100 governments have created some kind of cyber military command, some kind of military unit designed to fight and win wars in cyberspace. Indeed, the very first Pew poll to start 2014 found that Americans are more afraid of a cyber attack than they are of all the issues out there that we care about in world affairs. They're more afraid of a cyber attack than North Korean nuclear weapons, Iranian nuclear weapons, the rise of China, authoritarian Russia, climate change, you name it. Cyber attack scares them more. And so these fears, they've coalesced actually into a rapidly booming industry. In fact, one of the fastest growing industries in the entire world. The cybersecurity industry is on pace to reach $120 billion, doubling in size over the next 3 years. And another illustration of the marketplace would be in the last year, 80 different cybersecurity startups have exited onto the stock market through acquisition and IPOs with an average tenfold return on investment. We can also look at this booming market in terms of the bureaucracy, with new bureaucracies being created at the federal level, the state government level, including here in Florida, to the local level. To give you a sense of the numbers behind this, the Pentagon's budget in 2012 used the word cyber 12 times. This year's budget used the word cyber 147 times. Or a decade ago, there were 4 companies lobbying Congress on cybersecurity issues. Last year, over 1,500 companies registered to lobby Congress on it, which means also we have to worry about the rise of a cyber industrial complex out there. The bottom line, what I'm getting at here, is that for all the hope and promise of the digital age, if we're being honest, we also need to admit to ourselves that we've entered an era of cyber insecurity. Now, before I go much further, it's at this point that I'd like to do something a little bit counterintuitive, but maybe we'll help do that that message across to you. A lot like the challenge of how do you write a book about cybersecurity and cyber war and make it interesting and make it entertaining is how do you give a speech about it and make it interesting and entertaining? And that comes, of course, with the challenge of what kind of visuals can you do for a story about cybersecurity? And so if we're getting set in the back here, this should work for us. And you'll let me know if it's up on screen. All right. So what's going to play in front of you is a collection that I've put together of what I believe to be the best and the worst examples of cyber war art. That is, it's pictures that will tell the story of this emerging insecurity that's out there. And again, it's the best and worst examples of it. And this is to both drive home that story, it's to give you something to look at when you get tired of looking at me, but finally, there's an underlying reason for it. Studies have shown that you will retain 60% more of what you hear if you're looking at something at the same time. It actually doesn't have to do with anything that you're hearing. What you look and see can be disconnected. It's just the very strange way that our human brains are wired. And that's an important lesson when we're talking about cyber, is that you always have to go back to the human side of it, even when we're talking about something that seems so technical. So I'm not going to speak to these images. They're just going to keep playing for you. Now, to pull back on that, that's one of my favorite. Why write a book about cybersecurity and cyber war, and why now? There's 2 quotes that motivated me. The first is from President Obama, who declared that cybersecurity risks pose, quote, the most serious economic and national security challenges of the 21st century. The second quote is from the former CIA director, who said, quote, Rarely has something been so important and so talked about with less and less clarity and less apparent understanding. So it's that cross between something that we know is important but less understanding that drove us. And again, you can see this gap in all sorts of fields, also by the numbers. For example, 70% of business executives, not 70% of CTOs or CIOs, but business executives in general, 70% of them have made some kind of cybersecurity decision for their company, despite the fact that no major MBA program teaches it as part of your normal management responsibilities. Same thing can describe the schools where we teach our lawyers, our journalists, our diplomats. Or you can illustrate it not through numbers, but through all the sort of funny, but frankly, sad anecdotes that are in the book. For example, the former Secretary of Homeland Security, in charge of protecting the United States on the civilian side in cybersecurity, told us, quote, "Don't laugh, but I just don't use email at all." It wasn't a fear of security or privacy. It's because she just didn't think email was useful. That same problem doesn't just happen in the senior part of the executive branch. It happens on the judicial side. A Supreme Court justice told us that they thought email was useful, but they, quote, hadn't yet gotten around to email. They intend to get around to it at some point. They just haven't yet gotten to. In the upcoming year, they'll decide everything from the constitutionality of the NSA operations as revealed by Edward Snowden to net neutrality issues, and yet haven't yet gotten around to it. This is not just a problem in the United States. We met with officials in everywhere from China to Australia to Abu Dhabi, and the same thing came up again and again in terms of a disconnect between the importance of the area and yet the understanding of it at a basic level. And cybersecurity is as critical to personal issues like the security of your bank account, your personal privacy, but it also plays out on the geopolitical level. And in fact, those two issues connect to each other. The Snowden affair is both about personal privacy, but it's having geopolitical impact. But it's been treated as a domain only for the IT crowd, for the IT folks. And in turn, the technical community that understands the software and the hardware doesn't understand well the wetware, the people part of it. They look at the world through a very specific lens and often fail to appreciate the broader picture. And so this disconnect, this stovepiping, this failure to cross perspectives, it results in a series of diverse dangers. Each of us, in whatever role we play in life, makes decisions about cybersecurity that affects both the online world and the real world beyond it. But while we use the internet and while we make these decisions, we often do so without the proper tools. Very basic terms and essential definitions of not only what's possible, but what's proper, issues of right and wrong. These terms and definitions, they're missed, or even worse, they're distorted. Past myth and future hype weave together, obscuring what actually happened with what didn't and what won't or will happen. And so you get some threats are overblown and overreacted to, and other very real cyber threats are ignored. So, for example, I'm someone who loves history, and it absolutely pains me when I hear people say things like, cyber weapons is just like a WMD, or this is just like the Cold War. And I've heard everything from senators say this, to generals, to prominent newspaper columnists have written this, to White House officials have also said it. If you know both your history and the technical side, you quickly realize this comparison to the Cold War is not the one these people think they're making. It's actually to the early part of the Cold War, where we didn't understand not only the technology of nuclear weapons, but more importantly, we really didn't understand the political dynamics that they were driving. That period in time where we took Dr. Strangelove-like characters seriously. That's the parallel. One of the funny stories in the book, one of the scary stories, was that the Air Force actually developed an operational plan after the Sputnik launch to nuke the moon because we wanted to show the Soviets that we could do interesting stuff in space too. That kind of thinking is not what we should be drawing from today when it comes to the cyber side. So let me go into detail about some of the manifestations of this problem. One in particular is that we too often take unlike things and lump them together because they involve cyber. Take the idea of a cyber attack. The general, he recently retired, General Alexander, who was simultaneously the head of the NSA, the National Security Agency, and U.S. Military Cyber Command. Now pull back and think about that for a minute. Where else would we take two such important organizations and put the same person in charge of them? But that's not my point. He testified to Congress, quote, "Every day, America's armed forces face millions of cyber attacks," end quote. But to get that number, that idea of millions of cyber attacks every single day, he was combining everything from automated probes and address scans that never entered the computer network, to attempts to carry out pranks, to attempts to carry out political protest, to attempts to carry out theft, to attempts to carry out espionage. Espionage of a diplomatic nature, espionage of an economic nature, espionage of a national security nature. But none of those millions of attacks was what the people in that congressional hearing room thought he was talking about, which was the so-called cyber Pearl Harbor or cyber 9/11, a phrase that's been used in a series of government speeches and repeated over 500,000 times in the media. So what was happening is that we were taking all of these different things and lumping them together because they involve the very same technology. It would be a lot like saying, okay, I've got a group of teenagers carrying out some pranks with firecrackers. I've got a group of political protesters in the street using a smoke bomb. I've got a bank robber with a shotgun. I've got James Bond with his Walter PPK pistol. I've got a terrorist with a roadside bomb. I've got a Russian cruise missile. These are all one and the same thing because they all involve the technology of gunpowder, right? Wrong. We would never lump them all together, but we do that in this space. The same thing when it comes to the groups in this space. I had a senior U.S. military official argue with me that Anonymous, the online hacktivist group, and Al-Qaeda, the terrorist group, were one and the same thing. They actually share nothing in their personnel, their organizational structure, their goals, their means. The only two things these groups share is they're non-state actors that start with the letter A. You're not going to be effective lumping things together that way. So these gaps in understanding, these disconnects of policy and reality and technology mean that we're not only seeing growing tension, particularly between the U.S. and China, but we're also being taken advantage of. We're being taken advantage of at the individual level. When you get that email from that really nice Nigerian prince who just wants your bank account information because he wants to help you find riches. Now, we all laugh at examples like that. At the G20 conference, the most important diplomatic conference of the year, a group of senior government officials received what's called a spear phishing email. If you don't know what that is, the book explains it in simple ways. But essentially, they got an email that was tailored to them, and it had an incredible offer. If they would just click this link, they would be able to see nude photos of the former French First Lady, the one who used to be the model and rock star. This was an incredible opportunity. What diplomat could resist this kind of opportunity? And so, of course, they clicked the link, and they got the photos, but they also got spyware on their computers. We're being taken advantage of at the business level, at the organizational level, where we, again, alternatively don't do enough to protect ourselves, or we're taken in by hucksters. People and businesses that promise us 100% security if we just buy this silver bullet widget. Or we're frankly being taken advantage of at the national political level, which is, I believe, behind a number of the issues at play with the NSA. This can even happen to a president. Reportedly, Obama expressed his, quote, frustration that the complexity of the technology was overwhelming policymakers. So our inability to have a proper discussion in this space is not only leading to a distortion of the threats, it's also leading to a misapplication of the resources. Again, we can illustrate this with anecdotes or numbers. By the number, it's this: 31,300. That's the number of major media and academic journal articles that have focused on the phenomena of cyber terrorism. Zero. That's the number of people that have been hurt or killed by an actual incident of cyber terrorism. I joke that cyber terrorism is a lot like Discovery Channel's Shark Week, where we obsess about the danger from sharks, even though you're 15,000 times more likely to die on your toilet. But the difference is that Jaws, there's real versions of Jaws that have hurt people. We haven't had that happen yet in cyber terrorism. Now, let me be very clear here. I'm not saying that terrorists don't use the internet. There's several chapters in the book about how they use the internet. In many ways, it's just like us. I'm also not saying that there aren't real dangers of terrorist attacks using cyber, which is different than using the internet. And there's, I'm not saying there aren't potential real consequences here. And the weapon called Stuxnet, if you might have heard of, it was a cyber weapon that was created to sabotage Iranian nuclear research. It shows you, it's proof that we can do physical things with cyber weapons. But it's also an illustration that the barriers to entry are not as low as they're too often portrayed. Where, for example, there was a senior defense official who famously talked about how a couple of teenagers sitting in their parents' basement could carry out a WMD-style attack. No, they couldn't build something like Stuxnet if you understand the reality of it. Stuxnet involved everything from massive organizational resources. It involved expertise in everything from cyber, some of the top talent in the world from the U.S. and Israel. But it also involved expertise in areas that range from engineering to nuclear physics. They also built a working model of the physical target that they were going after. Because when you build a new weapon, you just don't toss it out there, you test it. These are not things that teenagers sitting in their basement have at their fingertips, whether it's PhDs in nuclear physics to working models of the centrifuge they're going after. The bottom line in this is, to put it another way, when it comes to cyber terrorism, Al-Qaeda would like to, but it can't. China could, but it doesn't want to. For both of them, yet. My bigger point, though, is not to talk about cyber terrorism. It's the idea that strategy, whether it's national-level strategy or your own personal strategy, it's always about choices. It's always about priorities. And so we have to weigh the centrality of what we talk about and what we obsess about versus the other things that are happening out there that I would argue are both real and greater in importance. So, for example, rather than cyber 9/11, we should be looking at what's happening right now in terms of the massive campaign of intellectual property going back to China. If you measure it in everything from jet fighter design stolen to oil company negotiating strategies to the design of a chair that a small New England furniture maker. If you put this together, we're living through the largest theft in all of human history playing out right in front of us. Okay, you say, well, I don't just care about economics, I care about national security. Well, of course, if you're talking about the theft of jet fighter designs, that has an impact on national security in the future. But again, maybe you don't care about the ripple effects. Let's focus in on just the military use of cyber. Well, don't just look at the sexy, the cyber Pearl Harbor, cyber 9/11. Look at how the military really does conduct cyber operations. To, if there is something that we've learned from traditional terrorism like 9/11, you should be focused on the ripple effects. It isn't just the attack, it's all of the ripple effects, including our own responses about it that made 9/11 such an important moment in world history. So if we're looking at cyber, it's the secondary effects. One of the things that deeply worries me is the combination of what three different forces are doing to this core human value called trust. When you talk about the massive campaign of cyber crime out there, not just the Chinese version of intellectual property theft, but things like the hacks on companies that range from whether you're a Target shopper or you're a Neiman Marcus shopper, or if you're at Neiman Marcus, you probably have a personal shopper go for you. But the point is, both those were hacked within the same week. This massive campaign of cyber crime out there. The second is our own government's actions to go after traditional forms of terrorism using mass data collection and observation, the NSA scandal as revealed by Snowden. And then the third trend is the push by authoritarian governments like the Russias and Chinas of the world to change the underlying governance of the internet, to put up the Chinese Great Firewall. Or in Russia, there's 82,000 websites on their blacklist, websites that you just can't go to. What these three things are doing, the combination, is they're hollowing out our trust in how the internet works and how it's worked so well. And it was mentioned, you know, I've got little kids. I'm deeply worried that if we don't watch out, the internet, which has been the most powerful force for economic, political and social change in my lifetime, and arguably in all of human history, if we don't watch out, the internet that's been so good to all of us is not going to be the one that our kids inherit. This gap in the field also means that we act on bad assumptions or don't make connections across different domains. So, for example, take the idea of cyber offense versus cyber defense. The U.S. is spending, the U.S. military is spending roughly 2.5 to 4 times as much on cyber offense research and development as cyber defense research and development. That is, when we're looking for that next critical breakthrough, we're putting 2 to 4 times as much money in hunting an offensive breakthrough versus a defensive breakthrough. There's a problem with that. One is, history teaches us that offense is not as dominant as we often think. And we're particularly at the 100-year anniversary of one of the biggest miscalculations among militaries of offense versus defense, where every single military in Europe back in 1914 thought offensive doctrine was the way to protect themselves. And they were deeply worried that, in fact, if they didn't find themselves on the offensive, if they were instead on the defensive, that they would lose the war. And so they urged their civilian governments, at the first point of crisis, we've got to go to war, because no one wants to be stuck on the defense. If you know your World War I history, actually to be on the defense was a pretty good deal, and they didn't have to accelerate that way. But maybe not history. This is better illustrated with a sort of a metaphor. When we think about offense, defense, and cyber, this is not a parallel to the Cold War. We're not in a binary relationship. There's multiple other actors out there, but we're also in a more fragile system. It's a lot like standing in a glass house, and for the U.S., this is given our dependence on cyber. It's a lot like standing in a glass house and looking around and saying, gosh, I've got to deal with everything from robbers to terrorists to multiple other militaries out there. Well, you know, the best way to protect my glass house is to buy a stone sharpening kit. Of course not, but that's the parallel here. So what can we do? The last third of the book is all of these what can we do type questions and answers. Everything from what can we do on the global level, what can we do on the national level, what can we do on the personal level. So I'm not to give away all the secrets, but basically hit 5 themes that cut across all of these levels of what can we do. Again, they apply to global down to just you thinking about the security of your own use of the internet. The first is knowledge matters. It's absolutely vital that we demystify this realm and understand that we're all responsible for it, and that if we don't understand that, we won't be effective at all in securing it. We have to move past the situation, for example, where a White House official describes cyber as the, quote, domain for the nerds. Well, guess what? It's not just the nerds that are online. We have to move past a situation where, for example, the president received a briefing on cyber issues and then asked reportedly for it repeated back, quote, this time in English. That's not a knock on President Obama. That would happen at every single major corporation, university, think tank, you name it, where we say, oh, this isn't for me to understand. Second issue, in trying to understand it, we need to realize that people matter. Cybersecurity is one of those wicked problem areas, not because of the technology, but because of the people part. All the different trade-offs and interesting ticks that come with people. We're complex, and that's why this is so complex. Now, that's great from a writer's perspective. So, for example, the book talks about the time you get these great human funny stories. And one, for example, is the time that Pakistan accidentally kidnapped all the world's cute cat videos for a day. That really happened. And we use that as a way to explain how the internet works on a system of trust. But beyond just thinking about kind of the cool stories, it means if you're trying to set up some response, again, whether it's a global level down to your own personal level, understand that people are behind both the threat and every single needed response behind it. This leads to the third issue, the third theme. Incentives matter. We're people and we operate in terms of carrots and sticks and the organizations that we're in and the reward structures and the trade-offs and the cultures. If you want to understand why something is, or even more importantly, isn't happening in cybersecurity, look to the incentives at play. There is a reason why finance companies are better at their own cybersecurity, but also one of these core human things that is the key to effective cybersecurity, which is called sharing. Why banks are better at securing themselves and sharing than power companies are. It's because of the incentives. They're set up to better understand the threat and also better motivated to develop good responses. But again, don't just focus on the easy narratives. Oh my goodness, the power grid, the companies will be under attack. This is, again, something that's out there. The electricity might go out. Well, squirrels have taken down the power grid more times than hackers have, because hackers have never taken down a power grid. But my point is, don't just focus on this kind of sexy narrative. Think about others. Healthcare industry, a leading cybersecurity expert laid out. You know, it's interesting. Healthcare actually has the largest number of reported intrusions. It's not the power grid. And his description of part of the why is this, quote, if our financial industry regarded security the way the healthcare sector does, I would stuff all my cash in a mattress. This also points to the role that government can and should be playing in this space. In some situations, government should be the trusted information provider. In other situations, it should be doing research and development where the market is not incentivized to go into, like what we've seen, for example, with drug research. And in other situations, it's going to have to change the market incentives through things like regulation, which has happened in every single other sector except this. So why should it be different? Fourth, history matters. There's a history to how we got here with the internet, and we need to accept that it's there and understand it. And it also allows us to not waste time on silly proposals. Like sometimes, and this has been, again, said by very serious people in Washington, D.C., the internet was built with no security in mind, so we should build a new, more secure internet. It's just not going to happen. It's not even worth spending time talking about it that way. But it's not just thinking about internet history. It's also thinking about history outside of the internet. So, for example, if you're worried about a realm, a domain of commerce and communication that's under threat from a mix of criminal actors, state actors, and then a fuzzy group in the middle that's kind of criminal and kind of state-linked, well, why not learn lessons from a parallel, like the Age of Sail and how they dealt with pirates, but also privateers, that group in the middle? Or if you're looking for the role of government, why not learn from the most successful government agencies in history? One model that we look at in the book is the Centers for Disease Control. It's a fascinating story that we go into. The CDC started with a couple of scientists taking a $10 collection, donation of $10. And it went on to do everything from eradicate malaria inside the U.S., to smallpox on a global level, to it served as a crucial back channel to the Soviets during the Cold War. This leads to the fifth and final theme. Ben Franklin had a saying that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. The CDC did studies in public health and found out Ben Franklin was right. He's also right in cybersecurity. While we want to make this incredibly complicated, very basic steps of what we could describe as cyber hygiene would go an incredibly long way. So, for example, for organization, there's what's called the top control measures. Very simple things to do, like, for example, don't allow hardware that you don't know where it's from on your network. Monitor for anomalies. These very basic things. A study was found that if they would just do that, 94% of all cyber attacks would be stopped. Now, we could go, okay, we're special. Well, first, statistically, we can't all be in the 6%. The second is when you talk to the IT department, they would say, you know what, if I didn't have to spend so much time running down the low-level stuff that would be stopped by basic cyber hygiene, I could focus in and stop the high-end stuff. But the third most important is most of the dangers actually happen through the low-end stuff, dangers to individuals, to dangers to government. As an example, the most important foreign government penetration of classified U.S. military networks happened when that foreign spy agency did what's called a candy drop. It's a lot like what it sounds like. They dropped something attractive, in this case a shiny object, a memory stick, in the dirt of a parking lot outside a U.S. military base. A soldier saw that shiny object in the dirt, picked it up, walked it inside the base, and curious said, I wonder what's on it, and plugged it into the classified U.S. military computer. That's not just cyber hygiene. That's basic hygiene. That's the five-second rule. But this idea of hygiene is not just about preventative measures, very basic preventative measures that protect yourself. And again, the one we were chatting about at lunch is passwords and not having the exact same password for all your different accounts so that someone can't daisy chain across it. It's also about having strong passwords. What's the most popular password out there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What's the second most popular password? Password. I mean, we can do better than this. But what I'm getting at is hygiene. I teach my kids, cover your mouth when you cough. That has no value to protecting them. I'm teaching them hygiene because it's also about an ethic of protecting everyone else that you come into contact with. And that's the same kind of ethic, that thinking about hygiene is both about protecting ourselves, but your responsibility for protecting everyone else that you connect with online. That's what we need to be driving at here. So to go full circle, at the beginning of the talk, I explained how I was first introduced to computers when I was a young kid. I was actually 7 years old. Now, if you had told me at the age of 7 that this machine, it was a Commodore, this machine would one day steal people's money, steal their identity, be a weapon of mass disruption, I would have begged my dad not to turn that machine on. How dangerous this machine must be. Today, I wouldn't have it any other way because that machine has given me and all of us in this room what back then we would have called a superpower. I can, for example, find out instantly the answer to any question. That was a superpower. That's the stuff of comic books. I can become friends with someone I've never met before, all online. We can go through all the different superpowers they've given us. And so the bottom line here is that I believe that's the way it's been and the way it should be when it comes to the cyber world. We have to accept and manage the risks of this world, whether it's the online world or the real world, because of all the incredible things we can do in it. And to steal a line from the book, that's really what everyone needs to know. Thank you.
Yeah. The microphones are set up, so if you'll just step up to them, we'll start with the questions.
Hi. I have a very simple question. I'm 96 years old. What is cyber? I don't know.
So, the question...
One of our younger members, by the
way. Well, no, it's funny because the question you asked is one that, in fact, even the U.S. military is still wrestling with. So, since the 1990s, the military has come up with 8 different definitions of cyber. And the definitions ranged. My favorite, for example, was one that said anything involving computers and the electromagnetic spectrum can be considered a threat. And so, therefore, it falls within our responsibility, which then meant that the military was, its job was to protect us against the sun, besides computer threats. And so, because that's on the electromagnetic spectrum. So when it comes to cyber, we're essentially talking about computers and the networks that they are on, the networks that link them together, and potentially the people behind them. And it's so what brings that all together. So that describes both the nature of the world, of the cyber domain, but also how we think about the difference between a cyber attack versus a physical attack. So a cyber attack is something that involves a computer. It doesn't involve, and therefore, it involves software across a network. So therefore, it's not kinetic. It's not physical. That makes it different than any kind of attack, so to speak, in history before, because it's not physical, it can be in multiple places at once. So Stuxnet was this software program, a computer software program that was designed to sabotage Iranian nuclear research. It got into their centrifuges and told their centrifuges to do things like spin faster, spin slower than the operating model. Go to a different temperature than what you're supposed to do. So it ruined what they were working on. And then it even caused the machine sometimes to spin out of control and damage themselves. So it was software that caused a physical impact. But what was interesting about it, again, different from any other weapon, is that while that weapon, that computer program, was in those Iranian machines, the very same software was in 25,000 other computers around the world at the same time. So this, again, is something we haven't seen before. It's also interesting in that, to continue the story of Stuxnet, it may have been the very first ethical weapon in all of human history, because it was designed to only cause harm to those Iranian nuclear centrifuges, their nuclear research. It's the only thing in the world that could be damaged by that software. In fact, even if you had in your basement a series of those centrifuges, it still wouldn't have harmed your centrifuges, only those ones in that one place in Iran. Of course, other people will say, that may be ethical in this one instant, but by opening up this whole new area of weaponry and war, it's like Pandora's box, because not everyone's going to design their weapons that way.
Some years ago, I guess 10 or 12 years ago, I was involved with a company, an e-commerce company, And I'm not a techie. I was on the board, so I didn't know the technical aspects of the company. But we had software program that would, if somebody downloaded one of our communications, that is, the somebody that was not the appointed the person that we were in communication with, then it would automatically self-destruct. That is, if somebody else got into the system, pulled it down to download it, it would automatically self-destruct. And that was 10 or 12 years ago. So I've always found it hard to understand why all these smart people that in the last 10 or 12 years haven't got something a whole lot better that works.
Well, so there's a couple of things here. One is to remember, again, that human side. So what, anytime when there is a defense, a new defense that's put in place against a threat, what does the attacker do? They come up with a different way to attack or a way to trick that system. And so it's the back and forth of this realm, and remembering it's the human side of it that drives it. That's, for example, when I gave you that astounding number that every single second, 9 new pieces of malware, of malicious software are found. Well, part of the reason for that is one of the primary ways that systems defend is they say, okay, this is what an attacking program looks like. It has these kind of attributes. So it's got 4 legs and pointy ears and a long nose. It looks like a horse. So what does a smart attacker do? It makes the horse striped, and now it's a zebra. So if your program says don't allow any horses in, the zebra comes in. What I'm getting at is there's always a back and forth in terms of that evolution. And so it leads to how we need to change our own attitudes from just keeping the attacker out to a resilience model, which is I'm going to power through the attacker. I'm going to, the way to think about it is the human body. Right now, my body and every single person in here, we're constantly under attack by millions and millions of microbes. In fact, just a square inch of your skin has over 1 million different of these microbes coming after it. We don't go, oh my gosh, we can't operate. Our system is set up to keep them out. But guess what? My body has 10 times as many foreign microbes in it as it does human cells, and every single one of yours does as well, because your body is set up to be resilient, to power through, to operate. It's also able to, if it's knocked down, recover, whether it's a cut to an infection. And we need to think about this here. And again, this notion of resilience is applies in a national level to your own personal level. Oh my, you know, one of the jokes or one of the lessons is if you can't bear to lose something, then prepare to lose it. Back it up. Think about your alternatives to it. It also, again, but to go to incentives, is too much of the incentives in the space psychologically have been to scare people. The incentive for the media is to say things like, you know, cyber 9/11 or the internet might go down was a famous Fox News report. The same for a company. If you just buy my widget, I'll give you 100% security. And we see these ads on TV and the like. We would never think that would work in the regular world. Why should we think it should work in the real world? You should certainly be thinking about security, but you should never assume that you're going to have 100% security. It's all about your resilience model.
Yeah, Peter, my question goes to the issue of governance and the long-term expectation of survival of the internet. The internet is an amazing creation, probably the only one I know of, where it operates on a consensus of everybody involved that it's a good thing and that benefits outweigh the cost. But we know that every government in the world has a different perception of the need for control and the risks involved in losing control. And that very much pertains to the internet. So the question goes to, what is the real expectation that this very fragile coalition, if you will, of agreement will last? It never has in history, And I can see a lot of threats to it that you've mentioned today that it probably won't in the future here.
It's a great question, and in many ways, great questions is another way of saying an unanswerable question. So there's a number of things at play here. You may have seen in the news 2 weeks ago these different news stories about U.S. to give up control of internet governance or the internet naming system, and people lamenting what this means. Well, what's playing out is, so the internet originally starts U.S. military funding. It's not about creating a communications network in the event of a nuclear war. It's actually about figuring out how scientists can share a scarce resource, which back in the day, the scarce resource was computers. How do you share computing time? And so they create a network to link them together. Now, those scientists then build out this network and the way it's governed following kind of the atmosphere that they're in, which is 1970s Northern California hippie scientists. It's all about openness. It's all about consensus. And guess what? It works. But now, multiple decades later, it reflects that. And some nations look at this and say, whoa, the internet's so important and there's so many different threats out there that government should be running the underlying model. This should be something, for example, that the UN won each government getting a vote. And the U.S., you shouldn't have this. At the end of the day, we have a contract that sets the system. The contract's let by the U.S. government. So U.S., you shouldn't have it in that way. It's not fair. It also reflects the internet has changed from being just this set of Northern California scientists, which means American, to then it was mostly Americans online, to then it was mostly English speakers online, to now we're moving to a system where next year there'll be more Chinese speakers online than English speakers. Africa's the fastest growing system. And so again, they're saying this needs to be something that's globalized rather than this model. So it should be both globalized and it should be something that states control. The worry, though, of this is just what you were hitting, is that these governments might see it as a way to control information, to control what's on the internet itself, so that information doesn't move back and forth. The blacklisted website model, as I mentioned, or the Chinese Great Firewall. The problem that one of the many victims of the Snowden affair was the U.S. strategy towards internet freedom, where we had a coalition of countries pushing back against this idea that it should be state-controlled, and there were a series of swing states in the argument, and the swing states were states like Brazil and India and Germany that are now incredibly angry about them being targeted by online NSA espionage. And also, it hit that argument that we were making of, trust us, we can be a good custodian of the internet's governance. So now we have to figure out a different way of approaching it. And so this is what the U.S. announcement was, is saying, okay, we're going to give up the contract, but we retain the right to veto whatever final model. And hopefully it's a multi-stakeholder model where we're all involved. But we'll see how this plays out. This is one of these big, big questions that'll play out over the next couple of years, whether that strategy of trying to give it up to internationalize it, but not allowing state control will win out.
Okay, over here, please.
First, to tell you a cartoon I saw last week where two dogs are talking. And one dog says to the other, I can't wait to bite my first email man. Another question, which maybe is too large for a wrap-up. Nothing has been said about how artificial intelligence might tie into this scenario or this. And is that just too big a topic to address at this time in your lecture?
Probably. I mean, the short answer to it would be, And it's funny because this links to the last book I did was on robotics and drones. We have this image of AI, and it's, from the movies, and it's HAL, or last night one of the Terminator movies was on Skynet. This AI is this thing that's not only incredibly smart, but also in making all of its own decisions, but it also has its own will. It's kind of a person inside the network. The reality is artificial intelligence is basically applying computers to do things that we used to previously consider intelligent. And so artificial intelligence is all around us, just not in our Hollywood image. If you've ever started to type a Microsoft Word document, you would get that annoying little paperclip that pops up beside it and says, it looks like you're typing a letter. Or for example, if you start to type and you spell something wrong, it automatically puts a little red line and says, spell check. That's artificial intelligence at work. To a skill set that used to require incredible expertise was to be a navigator. Now you have GPS in your car. My favorite example of this is two centuries ago, there was a profession that paid, on average, $200,000 per year. It was an incredible profession to be in. It was people that did mathematics for hire. They were called calculators. AI, artificial intelligence, has replaced that. But on the other hand, we're not in, you know, at least so far, HAL or Skynet.
Okay, we'll take one last question. You'll have to decide which one of you is going to ask it.
Recently, in the past years, there's been a large surge of the use of technology in Africa, specifically with farmers. And I was curious how you think that we could lay a foundation with these individuals that would lead to the best optimization of this technology and cyber hygiene, as you mentioned.
It's a great question, and it hits an earlier one in terms of Africa's one of the booming growth areas of people coming online. One of the funny ways you can illustrate it in terms of the changing internet and who's on it is that I made the joke about cute cat videos. You know, we know the cute cat video online. Google data shows that actually cute cat videos are losing out to cute panda bear and cute goat videos because pandas in China and goats are very popular from African users. So it's a great illustration through that of how the internet and who uses it is changing. It's going to be very empowering in Africa. And it is very empowering in terms of people coming online and getting information that previously wasn't accessible to them, information on everything from what the price of their crop, what should they actually be paid? What is the market 200 miles away really paying for that wheat that they're growing versus what they're being told? Now they can get the answer to, I spoke with another police chief who's using it to help. They don't have a 911 network, so the way the town mobilizes to go after fires is he spreads the word on Twitter. So incredibly powerful. But the very same thing that I was talking about of the risks, if security isn't woven into it, and particularly in Africa, there's some challenges there, it holds the potential of being a home for cybercrime, people taking advantage of lower levels of security. So again, just like on the broader thing to end on, incredible positives, but also risks, just like everything else in the world. Cyber's no different. Thanks again for coming out.